Good morning, everybody. Good morning, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order May 13th, 2022, 7 minutes after 9 a.m. With me today is Senator Wilikowski, Senator Wilson, Senator Hoffman, and myself, Stedman. We do have a quorum. We have a couple of action items today. We have asked the legislative finance, the nonpartisan financial arm of the legislature, to come before the Finance Committee, give us an update on the financial position of the budget as it sits pre-conference committee, and the final version of the Senate being sent over to the House and in the House's possession, asking for non-concurrence and to send it back so we could have a conference committee and work out our differences and iron out some a lot of little things in the operating budget so the agencies can run smooth for the next fiscal year. So with that, Mr. Painter can come forward, Director of Legislative Finance. He's got a presentation we're going to walk through, a couple of their additional slides. After that, we're going to have a presentation by Senator Wilikowski dealing with Senate Bill 107, dealing with oil and gas production, a tax and credits. He's been anxiously waiting all year or longer to present that to the committee, so he'll have his opportunity today. So with that, Mr. Painter, if you can introduce yourself for the record, briefly tell the public what you do and how partisan your operation is, and then tell us what's going on with our proposed budget and its magnitude, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Alexi Painter, I'm the Director of the Legislative Finance Division, and we work for all 60 legislators and specifically the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee, so we're not partisan. So we're going to go over several things in this presentation. First, we'll start by an update on the spring revenue forecast and the current oil market. We'll go through an updated fiscal summary that reflects the Senate budget. We will summarize some of the changes between the Senate finance budget and the House budget to the Senate budget that passed the body. We'll step back and kind of look at the big picture of how the Senate budget handles the oil price spike that we've seen in the last few months. We'll project FY24 and beyond, and then discuss new revenue options. So to start with, the members of this committee should be familiar with this slide. This slide compares the Department of Revenue's fall revenue forecast, the oil price in that, to the spring forecast. The blue line is the fall forecast. The orange line is the spring forecast, which is $101 a barrel in FY23. And then that gray line is the futures market as of yesterday. You can see that the futures market is still tracking very close to the spring revenue forecast. At this point, it's about $2 below in FY22 and 23, which is, you know, in the realm of oil price forecasting, very small, but in the realm of Alaska's revenue, actually pretty significant. $2 of oil is, you know, $150 to $200 million of revenue. So it's even though that's a pretty minor difference on that chart, it is a big difference when we're talking about our savings balances. This next slide shows the oil prices in this fiscal year to date. You can see that there was a bit of a run-up starting in the new year. Prices had been in the $70 to $80 range, peaking in, you know, about $85, and then sort of steadily marched up through the early part of the year before spiking with the Russian invasion of Ukraine. The Department of Revenue's spring revenue forecast was taken at a particularly volatile time, but as we saw in that last chart, the futures market is still actually reflecting pretty close to that. But since that point, when the spring forecast has happened, we've had quite a bit of volatility, with prices going from below $100 a barrel to as high as $125 a barrel, so a pretty wide range. Throughout the fiscal year as a whole, we have a range from about $70 to $125 a barrel in daily prices. So there's been a pretty wide range. This has been a relatively volatile year for oil so far. And so when we see volatile oil in ledge finance, we tend to encourage the legislature not to focus on, one price that's the forecast, which that $101 a barrel, but to look at the entire chart, this that entire sensitivity line. That orange line is the spring revenue forecast at various prices. So you can see it's not quite linear. It because our production tax is progressive, it accelerates a bit as we get to higher prices. And we always encourage the legislature to look at how the budget would perform at a range of prices, because that, you know, $101 a barrel is obviously just one price in that entire volatility between, you know, 70 and 125 that we've seen this year. So we'd really encourage you to look at that broader range. So if you go down to $70 a barrel, we're looking at revenue, oil revenue of something like $2.5 billion. If you go up to $125 a barrel, you're looking at $6.5 billion. So a very wide range just from within the prices that we've seen this year. And actually, this slide should be at the end, so I'm going to skip it and come back to it. Sorry, we have a kind of did this presentation pretty last minute, so we'll return to this slide at the very end. So slide 7 shows the fiscal summary of the Senate budget, and we'll be on this slide for a little bit, so I'm going to walk through it. For the members of the committee, will probably be a little bit of review, but for the members of the public, will maybe helpful. So at the top, we have our revenue, and it's structured to break out the fall revenue forecast here on line 2, and then the spring increase over that forecast. So you can see that when we got that new revenue forecast, once oil prices spiked, the revenue expectation in FY22 increased by $1.2 billion and then $2.4 billion in FY23. So between the years, something like $3.6 billion of additional revenue between that fall and spring forecast. The next line, line 4, is the percent of market value draw from the permanent fund, which is 5% both years. And so altogether, we are projecting about $7 billion of unrestricted general fund revenue in FY22 and about $8.3 billion of unrestricted general fund revenue in FY23, higher because of the expectation of higher oil prices in that year.
Mr. Painter, could you tell us what the draw is this year on the permanent funds 5% in dollars?
Mr. Chairman, yes. So in fiscal year 22, that draw was $3.069 billion. In FY23, it went up to $3.360 billion. That increase is reflecting the investment performance in FY21, which was very strong.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are we on track to meet the 2022 revenue forecast?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, right now we are running about $2 below, so something like $150 to $200 million below that forecast at this point, based on the prices to date and the futures market. So this slide does use the spring forecast, but I'd encourage you to kind of keep that in mind, that right now we are slightly below it. Okay. And I should note also, with the investment volatility this year, we've seen some negative returns after a very strong year last year. The percent of market value draw for FY23 does not depend on market performance this year. There's a lag year in the percent of market value draw. So that number, that $3.36 billion, is fixed already. The investment performance this year in fiscal year 22 in the permanent fund will affect the POMV draw in fiscal year 24, but it will not affect anything in FY23. So going down to the operating budget, in line 8, we can see agency operations. In FY22, agency operations were about $3.9 billion. And then this year, they went up to about $4.185 billion, so an increase of $265 million or 6.8%. We have a placeholder here for the K-12 disparity test. The reason for that is that there's some fear that the state is we may fail that disparity test, which would increase state costs for education. There, we should have some more details next week, but obviously in preparing the budget, it's probably prudent to make sure that we have the money to pay for that in the event that we do fail. Line 10 shows our statewide items. Those are things like debt service and fund capitalizations and appropriations to the retirement funds. Those increased by $349 million, from $414 million to $763 million. This reflects a few things. One is with the higher revenue forecasts, the statutory tax credit calculation is higher. So that's one of the increases, as well as last year, several statewide items were only partially funded. So school debt reimbursement, REA fund capitalization, and the community assistance fund capitalization were all partially funded last year, and they're fully funded in this year's budget. So those all contribute to those increases. Those partial funding of those items is made up in line 12, those operating supplementals. And on a future slide, we'll go through what some of those are, but several of those are paying back those past items, those past statewide items like school debt reimbursement, the REA fund, and community assistance, as well as other items. On line 11 is the energy relief payment that was not part of the Senate finance budget. It was part of the House budget and then was adopted on the Senate floor. That is an amount necessary to pay a $1,300 payment through the PFD program to eligible Alaskans, or Alaskans who are eligible for the PFD. And so that would be, we're estimating that that would be $840 million to pay that $1,300 per person. So altogether, in the operating budget with supplementals, the FY22 was $4.9 billion. We're going up to about $5.9 billion, an increase of 19.3%. A lot of that increase is due to the energy relief. Going down to the capital budget, so this year in the capital budget, the Senate Finance Committee had structured the budget to split the capital appropriations between fiscal years 22 and 23 to take advantage of the more certain revenue in FY23. And so the budget as it left Senate Finance had about $400 million of capital appropriations here on line 14 in FY23, the remaining 320-something million in FY22. As amendments were adopted on the Senate floor, they were primarily effective in FY23, so now that FY23 number is significantly higher than as it left the Senate, or as it left the Senate Finance Committee. So the total capital budget, it looks like $830 million. Really, we'd encourage you to combine these two together, line 15, the capital supplementals, and then the FY23 appropriations for about a $1.1 billion UGF capital budget in the Senate budget.
Before we go to the next section, you'd mentioned that there were some amendments, capital amendments on the floor of the Senate. Could you remind us what they were and the rough magnitude of the dollar amounts?
Mr. Chairman, yes. We have a little more on that in a future slide, but the largest, actually I just skipped to that so I don't get the numbers wrong. So skipping ahead to slide 9, so there were $416 million added to the capital budget. $175.3 million of that was for the Nome Port. $175 million of that was for the Port of Alaska. There was $25 million in the budget as it left Senate Finance, so $200 million total. $30 million for MATSU transportation infrastructure, and then $24.3 million UGF combined for smaller projects.
And then just back to the number 7, page 7. So that magnitude at 400 and some million, as I recall, that appears to be bigger than the capital budgets in the last decade, or close to a decade. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, yes. That would be, if just the $400 million alone would have been the largest capital budget since FY15. FY16 through 22, the capital budgets were all smaller than that. Okay, going down to the permanent fund section, starting on line 16. So last year the dividend was, or on line 17, last year the dividend was $739 million, paying out a bit over $1,100 per person. On the Senate floor, the dividend for FY23 was changed to an amount equal to the statutory dividend. It's not actually, it doesn't have the language saying follow the statute. It just has an amount equal to the estimated statutory dividend, which is $2.76 billion. That would pay about $4,200 per eligible recipient, depending on the number of recipients. And
then maybe total that out, and I have some questions.
Sure. And so that energy relief payment on line 11 will also be distributed through the dividend program. The Department of Revenue, essentially their statute says, you know, whatever's in the dividend fund, you distribute as a permanent fund dividend. So putting extra money and calling it energy relief still goes out through the dividend program. So combined, that's about $3.6 billion, and would pay about $5,500 per eligible recipient.
So remind me again, how much came in from the permanent fund on the draw, and is it, what's the relationship there?
Mr. Chairman, the POMV draw this year is $3.36 billion, so that combined amount exceeds that. However, because the energy relief is coming out of the general fund, there's no overdraw of the permanent fund in this budget. However, the combined dividends do exceed the POMV draw this year.
By $300 million.
Correct.
Okay, and then when you total all this up, the reoccurring revenue in 23 projected, and our expenditures for operating capital in the permanent fund, what's the total? How much surplus do we have on the table?
Mr. Chairman, on line 19, you can see the pre-transfer surplus or deficit. In FY23, that pre-transfer deficit is about $1.1 billion. In FY22, there's a pre-transfer surplus of about $553 million. There's quite a lot going on in fund transfers this year and paying for things, so I'll pause on those numbers before I get onto that. But in terms of just the recurring revenue, this would be a $1.1 billion deficit in FY23.
And you're telling us that our recurring revenue up against recurring expenditures plus additions of the energy dividend and some capital budget items exceeds our revenue intake by $1.1 billion. At what price of oil is this calculated at?
Mr. Chairman, this assumes the spring forecast of $101 a barrel. And, you know, as we get into some of the complexities here, I think it's important to note that the Senate budget has a provision that deposits any oil revenue that's received above $100 a barrel into the permanent fund. So that acts as kind of a revenue cap. So, you know, I've been asked over the past few days, what price does this budget balance? There's no price that would balance this budget, because any revenue that's exceeded because the price is higher just goes into the permanent fund. It doesn't go to the general fund to reduce the deficit. So essentially that $697 million post-transfer deficit, that's the smallest that could be based on revenue, because any revenue beyond that would just go to the permanent fund.
So if we were expecting, what you're trying to tell us is, I think if I'm hearing you right, if oil was $116 or $120 or $125, makes no difference in the balancing this budget. We still have to go back and look at some other saving sources to plug that $1.1 billion deficit?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. So the Senate budget, as constructed at this point, has that $1.1 billion deficit filled out of the statutory budget reserve utilizing the surplus in fiscal year 22, as well as using ARPA revenue replacement. So we have, last year, we got a bit over $1 billion from the federal government to use for COVID expenses, as well as replacing lost revenue. And so this budget utilizes the remaining $500 million of that after last year, or $486.6 million for revenue replacement. So that's part of how this gets paid for is, you know, you can see on line 21.
Okay, we'll stop there for a minute. Sure. I'm going to have Senator Hoffman ask this question, and then when we're done with that, we'll go down into how we fill this hole of $1.1 billion when the price of oil won't help us. If the price of oil was $200, it wouldn't make any difference. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On line 19, the $1.1 billion is a direct result. The deficit is a direct result of actions that happened on the Senate floor, and let the general public know that the budget that was forwarded on to the floor had a balanced budget. The problem that I have today is that statutorily and constitutionally, we are obligated to balance our budget. So This gives me great concern, and the rumblings around the building of what may or may not happen in the other body. So it might be prudent that as a result of this the floor action, it may be prudent for the legislature or the Senate Finance Committee to request the bill back from the other body. So I would put that on the floor, because we are constitutionally required to have a balanced budget. We should do our work, and not if what happens on the other body, and I don't know what's going to happen, but to for them to accept the Senate's version, original version, is highly unlikely, and any action that they may have regarding the $1.1 billion deficit, I don't think there's a path forward to accomplish that. And as a result of the requirements that we have to statutorily and constitutionally to balance the budget, to leave that up to the governor to resolve isn't doing our work. So I just wanted to put that on the record.
Mr. And just as a follow-up on that, I think, as I recall, when that budget left the table, we had $1.2 billion, which is pretty close to the deficit number here, but positive $1.2 billion into forward funding education. What happened to that, Mr. Painter? I was expecting to see that here today.
Mr. Chairman, so that's on line 23, but it's a zero. The reason for that is that that provision is written so that forward funding will only occur if there is sufficient revenue to have a surplus before that item. So in the budget as it left Senate Finance, there was a surplus in FY23. One of the disposition of part of that surplus was to go to forward fund education. In this budget, since there's a deficit and that's filled out of the SBR, there's no forward funding. So that while that item remains in the bill, it's functionally zero.
So if, as I recall, that started to fill that $1.1 billion forward funding education at $85 roughly, and completed filling it up to $1.2 billion, the cap, at $100, and then the revenue, if we have revenue or oil prices in excess of $100, then would flow to the permanent fund, capping the funds available for forward funding at $1.2, and any need to draw on the SBR or the CBR for any funds to make our expenditures. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. So as the budget left Senate Finance, essentially, you know, if oil was at least $84, the budget would balance with no forward funding. Then if prices exceeded $84 up to about $99, that would fill up that forward funding bucket. So if prices were somewhere in the 80s or 90s, there would be some money going into forward funding. If they were 99, it would be fully funded, and then anything over $100 a barrel would go into the permanent fund. So essentially the budget would balance anywhere from $84 up, with that forward funding being sort of the buffer to catch that savings and between those numbers.
And I have to agree with Senator Hoffman, we have a constitutional obligation to balance the budget and do our work, not only here at the Finance Committee, but on the floor of the Senate. So it is an issue to have a budget this far upside down. And the only reason it was stopped is because there was a termination of the amendments coming. So can you explain then to the committee how we deal with $1.1 billion negative? Do we pass the hat around the state and everybody chip in, or what do we do to...
Mr. Chairman, there's a few provisions in here to deal with that. So I mentioned earlier that there's the remaining $486.6 million from the coronavirus state and local fiscal recovery fund. That's used in this budget to replace lost revenue. And so that you can see that on line 21. There was $250 million used last year, and then $300 million additional in this budget in FY22. And then the remaining 186.6 in FY23. So that goes to pay for part of the the deficit. And then the other mechanism is on line 25, you can see there's a direct appropriation into the statutory budget reserve of $660 million, as well as that on line 26, that post-transfer surplus in FY22 of $840 million. That is also directed to the statutory budget reserve. So combined, those are almost exactly $1.5 billion projected. And so that $1.5 billion of surplus in FY22 is carried forward into FY23 and then drawn out to fill the deficit. $350 million of that on line 20, it was directly funded capital projects from the SBR. The remaining about $700 million would be deficit draws. So to kind of recap that, in FY22, we put about $1.5 billion into the SBR. In FY23, we draw about $1.05 billion from the SBR. So in net across the fiscal years, we're actually adding about $450 million to the SBR, but that's created using that FY22 surplus and then drawn out most of that in FY23. And as Senator Wilikowski asked about earlier, oil is slightly below the forecast at this point. So, you know, the numbers here on the side saying that the statutory budget reserve would fall to zero at about $93 oil in FY23, that assumes we hit the forecast in FY22. If we're a couple dollars under, then that break-even price of $93 would rise a little bit. So, you know, we may say that $93 is a little optimistic. Right now we're looking probably $94, $95 to make up for the fact that we're a little under in this fiscal year.
And just as a reminder, on line 25, 660, $660 million going into the statutory budget reserve, that's roughly the amount of savings we pulled out last year, along with some federal COVID money, to pay the $1,100 dividend. So one of the first actions the committee wanted to do was replace that $660 million to put us at net zero to the position when we left early last summer. So that is a replacement of monies that were removed from the Treasury to make things work last year to get out an $1,100 dividend. And if you can explain line 20, please, on the 350, why is that there and how it fits in this puzzle?
Mr. Chairman, so one of the amendments that was adopted on the floor that funded the port projects, among others, directly funded $350.3 million of those items out of the statutory budget reserve rather than from the general fund. So essentially they were filled out of that savings account rather than through there. So we kind of split up that draw from the SBR into those direct appropriations on line 20 and then just any deficit filling amounts in line 26, but they're coming from the same place, which is the statutory budget reserve. They're just a slightly different mechanism. And that's why we usually encourage people to look at that pre-transfer deficit line 19, because that post-transfer deficit number is a little misleading, because that's after we've, you know, done direct appropriations and things like that that are not necessarily indicative of our ongoing finances.
So it's backfilled.
Correct.
That's what you're saying.
Sure.
So as I recall, when that amendment hit the floor, the Treasury or the budget was already underwater, upside down, starting at $1.2 billion positive. That was erased, and we're down into the negative numbers, substantial negative numbers. So to avoid that conflict, those amendments were written to draw the money out of the savings account instead of reoccurring revenue.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. And then a subsequent amendment added the deficit-filling language from the statutory budget reserve that filled that, you know, $700 million or so in line 26.
Right. So, and this was an ongoing issue throughout the evening as these amendments kept being written and didn't work. That's the, they're squawking about the deficit too. So anyway, I just wanted to point that out. That the spending didn't stop when we hit zero. The spending continued until the hole kept getting so deep there was no return. So then where does that leave us? You want to talk about the reserve balances? I guess the next section you have?
Mr. Chairman, yes. So in the bottom right corner, we have this box that's the reserve balances. So the statutory budget reserve at the forecast would have just over $500 million, $522 million left. That had about $70 million coming into FY22. So, you know, roughly zero, then we, well, $70 million, then we add net $450 to the SBR over the 2 years. As I mentioned earlier, oil is volatile, so if oil is higher than $100, it doesn't really affect this picture because it just goes into the permanent fund. If oil is lower, then that would result in increased deficits. So that $500 million would be erased at about $93 oil. And then this, the bill as drafted, as passed by the Senate, doesn't actually have further deficit filling language. So if prices were below $93, it doesn't specify how that would be filled. If there were CBR access, which would require a three-quarters vote, that would get you through about $75 oil before that would be drained as well. There could also be access to the earnings reserve account with a majority vote. That has about $15.6 billion projected at the end of FY23. But again, neither of those are authorized in the current budget.
Okay. So I guess I'm wondering why we're even having a hearing. We got $15 billion in earnings reserve. What's plus another $1.3 billion in the CBR and some pocket change at $500 million? What's the issue? We got lots of money.
Mr. Chairman, I think it goes back to a few slides ago that oil is very volatile and, you know, counting on a given price has risk. So if you are balancing your budget at $100 a barrel, that's significantly more risky than balancing your budget at $70 or $80 a barrel. And so depending on geopolitical events over the next year, this budget could come out looking just fine, where we do have that $500 million left in the SBR, or we could end up draining the statutory budget reserve and having an unfilled deficit to deal with in January. It just depends on how oil would go. So I think that would be my comment on this, is that it's a question of how you'd prioritize how much to save and what level of risk the legislature is willing to bear.
So this ERA, that's the earnings reserve account of the permanent fund, I think, $15.6 billion forecasted. Does the dividends come out of that? So if we spend that, what happens to the dividends?
Mr. Chairman, so the earnings reserve is part of the permanent fund. It's part of the POMV calculation that we get that $3.36 billion, our stable revenue there from. So if we spend additional amounts out of the earnings reserve, that will result in smaller POMV draws in the future and will increase future deficits. You know, if we're following the statutory PFD formula, then it would reduce PFDs. If we're following another PFD formula, it may or may not. We haven't followed the PFD formula since FY16, I believe. But in statute, that is the source of the permanent fund dividend.
Okay. So the point being, the earnings reserve account is the account where the funds are to pay the dividend. And if that's not healthy to facilitate that, there is no dividends. Pretty straightforward. So in this, before we go on, just to reiterate, the way this budget looks now, we got $3.3 billion rounded off coming from the permanent fund, that's line four. And then we add the spending components, or subtract the spending components of it, line 17 and line 11. We're spending $300 million more on dividends and related to a dividend, the energy rebate, than the permanent fund is producing. I got that correct?
Mr. Chairman, yes, that's correct.
Okay. Next page, I guess.
Mr. Chairman, so this next slide shows what we call the swoop graph that compares the size of various expenditures from the largest to smallest, so you can see the relative size of everything. The red bars on the left are the FY22 management plan. The blue bars on the right are the Senate budget. And so we start with the PFD, combining the statutory PFD and the energy relief payment, about $3.6 billion. The largest state agency is the Department of Education that is in the Senate budget, $1.36 billion, so you know, a bit more than a third of that. So the PFD payments combined, you can see this very small on the slide, but it's about 38.5% of our unrestricted general fund expenditures in this budget. And, you know, for, I'd note that for simplicity, we stacked the two new departments, Health and Family and Community Service, together to compare to last year. That historically has been our second largest agency after the Department of Education, but with the split, the Department of Health will be our second largest agency.
Any questions on this magnitude? We had the chart reconstituted and asked Ledge Finance to present that back to the committee, because it's not the individual dividend going out, it's the cumulative total of all of them, and we always talk about the individual dividend being 4,200 or 1,100 or 2,600. Rarely do we talk about the aggregate dollars it takes to produce it, and that's the challenge at the table. Next slide, please.
All right, slide 8. It's kind of a recap of things we already discussed a couple of slides ago, but just to quickly reiterate how the flow of savings works. So in FY22, there's about $1.5 billion deposited into the SBR. In FY23, about $1.05 billion is withdrawn from the SBR. So that means across the 2 years, an estimated $450 million would be estimated to be deposited into the SBR, assuming we hit the spring forecast. If we do exceed that spring forecast, the additional amounts go into the permanent fund, not the SBR. If they're below, then there would be less in savings. So the SBR could fill that down to about $93 a barrel. Below that, we would need an additional source to fill the deficit. So either the CBR or the ERA would be the likely funds.
So explain to the committee how that would happen, or mechanics. We have access available in language in the budget, so we can go to the statutory budget reserve, and if it goes dry at 93 or goes dry at 95, and the oil prices bounce pretty easy in that range in a day or two, and what can we expect in the future time-wise if that was to happen? When would the alarm bells go off that it's actually a cash flow issue? Or do we just don't worry about it till a year from now when we do another budget?
Mr. Chairman, I think it depends on how when that price shift would happen. If something happens in the short term, we would probably need to come back for a special session if things, you know, if it became clear in the summer that $93 oil was not going to happen. If the forecast is looking relatively close, I would guess that we could wait until January in a supplemental to attempt to find a deficit filler. It would really depend on the severity of the problem and when that occurs. With the volatility of oil revenue, oil can change very quickly, so it's possible that could be sooner rather than later. It could be at the very end of the year. We'll never know, or we'll find out.
On this slide, slide 8.
Okay.
Slide 9.
So slide 9, I touched on this a little earlier, but again, to summarize, so the Senate finance budget compared to the Senate budget, there were a number of increases. So the first one was that the PFD increased. The Senate finance budget had a PFD that was 50% of the POMV draw, about $1.68 billion to pay about $23.50 per recipient. And then the one in the Senate budget is an amount equal to the estimated statutory PFD, which is, that should be a decimal there after the two, a comma after the two, not a decimal, but that's $2,764,000,000. That would pay about $4,200 per recipient. The Senate on the floor also added $840 million for a $1,300 energy relief payment, and then $416 million for the capital budget. About $350 million for those two port projects, as well as $30 million for Mat-Su transportation infrastructure, and then $24.3 million of smaller projects. In total, there was also a a couple of very small operating items that primacy for RCRA, as it's called in DEC, and then a couple of salary adjustments. In total, the Senate floor amendments added $2,342,000,000 to the budget across the two fiscal years. And so the result of that is reduced savings compared to the Senate finance budget. We mentioned K-12 forward funding. That was $1.2 billion. That now becomes zero. And the Senate finance budget deposited just under $1.6 billion into the SBR. And then this, because of those amendments, there's less revenue available. So now there's only $450 million going into the SBR and the Senate budget.
And just as a reminder, we spent quite a bit of time talking about the liquidity position. The state should be in as a minimum range just to operate and have some ability to handle fluctuating oil prices. And we're targeting it around $4 billion. And just for those watching at home, I'd like to remind them that wasn't but a handful or so years ago, we had $16, $18 billion set aside to deal with the volatility. It's the magnitude of the problem or potential impact that is of a concern. It doesn't take us long in a downward spike of oil prices to evaporate $1 billion, $2 billion. Go ahead and continue.
All right. Slide 10 summarizes some of the major differences between the House and Senate operating budgets. Not including the PFD that we talked about. So there's several other differences in the operating budget. The House, of course, did not have a capital budget as part of their operating bill. They introduced their own bill later on, but it wouldn't be conferenceable if this bill went to conference. So in the operating budget, the House budget replenishes the Alaska Higher Education Fund in FY22 and then uses it to pay scholarships in FY23. While the reverse sweep vote that would keep that fund available in FY23 failed, the House did pass legislation that would have the effect of making that higher education fund not sweepable. That legislation, I believe, is in this committee right now. So even though that in the House budget that that fund is swept, their legislation would keep it around. So if this committee wanted to replenish the higher ed fund as part of passing that legislation, there would need to be a vehicle for fiscal notes, but also that would consume about $400 million of the $500 million left in the SBR to do that. So it essentially would wipe out our savings if we did that with the Senate budget. Excuse me. The Senate budget includes significant structure changes in a few agencies, the Department of Revenue, the Department of Fish and Game, and the Office of the Governor. And those were not part of the House budget, so there's pretty significant differences in how those three agencies are structured between the two budgets. There's quite a few differences in the University of Alaska between the two. So the House budget has $29.8 million of University of Alaska projects that utilize the Coronavirus State and Local Fiscal Relief Fund. The Senate did not fund any of those items. Both of them funded additional amounts for fixed costs at the University of Alaska. The Senate actually had $5.5 million more than the House, but, again, didn't have those other projects. The other difference is in structure. Again, the Senate utilizes a two-appropriation structure, which is what was used in the previous year's budget. The House has a single appropriation structure, which is how the governor proposed it and what the University Board of Regents has said that they prefer as well. The House also includes a structure change in their budget that's intended to prevent Medicaid spending on abortion. The Senate did not include that in the budget. And then the House included $4.9 million for wastewater or for 404 primacy, as it's called, which is over wetlands, not wastewater, in the Department of Environmental Conservation. They also had a $750,000 supplemental for the same purpose. That amendment did not pass in the Senate, so that is not part of the Senate budget. There's also a number of smaller differences as well as some more technical things, but these are kind of the major differences. All right, so slide 11, we're kind of stepping back a little bit, sort of go back in time a little bit to where we were in December, and then a couple of slides from now we'll talk about where we were all the way back last September, which feels like a long time ago, but we were not that long ago when we were looking at a very different budget picture. So in December, with the fall revenue forecast, the governor's budget as submitted back then had combined across the two fiscal years a surplus of about $171 million as a post-transfer surplus. The governor utilized the ARPA funding partially for revenue replacement, partially for added spending. If we add that part that he spent on added spending back to the UGF available, that's another $100 million. So, you know, looking at $280 million there available. The spring forecast, as I said earlier, added about $3.6 billion of revenue. So if we compare to what the governor utilized in his budget, there's something like $3.9 billion of surplus across FY22 and 23 that was available to the legislature this session. So the legislature chose to spend it in the ways that we see in these next two boxes. So nearly $3 billion of that went to spending increases. The largest of those is for the higher PFD, and I'd note that the governor had a 50-50 proposal as well as a supplemental PFD of about $800 million. So the comparison, the $1.1 billion, is in addition to that. If you don't include the supplemental PFD in the governor's calculation, just compared to the 50-50 in FY23, the Senate budget spends about $1.9 billion more on PFDs than the governor's FY23 budget. $900 million of that increased revenue went to increasing the capital budget beyond the governor's original submission. About $464 million went to operating supplementals, and we'll detail some of those in the next few slides. And then about $250 million each went to increases in agency operations and increases in statewide items. And you know, since I'm comparing back to December, some of these came in as governor's amendments for the infrastructure bill and to the main bill. Some of these were House ads. Some of these were Senate ads. It came from all over the place. But in all, of our $3.9 billion we had available above the governor's budget, about $3 billion went to spending. The remaining amount went to savings. So $300 million or so is going to the permanent fund. I mentioned the $106 million estimated for the oil being over $100 a barrel. There's also $199 million to pay past royalty deposits. And then that $450 million going into the SBR that I mentioned earlier. So just at a high level, sort of what did we do with that revenue spike compared to where we were back in December? Okay. And the next couple of slides, we'll get into sort of what these increases are that made up that nearly $3 billion in spending. So the governor's budget had a number of increases from FY22. The largest was $45 million from Medicaid. There was also $33.6 million to offset the impact of the sweep to the Constitutional Budget Reserve. The several designated general funds were deposited in the CBR at the end of FY21, and so the governor replaced all of those appropriations with UGF. There's now $27 million for kind of automatic adjustments and health insurance and union contracts. I think every time I've presented this slide, that number's changed, but I think we're out of unions at this point to add, this year anyway. There's $17.4 million of combined increases in the Department of Public Safety, so the governor's budget added more troopers, village public safety officers, and increased their salaries as well as other support positions. There's $12.9 million of increases in the Department of Corrections, some of that going to Highland Mountain, the booking and mental health units there, and adding support positions that are not correctional officers. About $5.7 million to DEC for the primacy programs, I mentioned those before. $4 million to the Department of Law for State of Defense, and then $3.8 million for fire suppression preparedness. So these are the large items added by the governor in the operating budget. There were some other smaller ones, but these are the major ones.
Great.
Going on to slide 11B, sorry about the confusing numbering here. Things got added kind of last minute. So these are major increases in the Senate budget over the governor proposal. The largest was $60 million to K-12 education outside the base student allocation formula. The House budget had $57 million, and the Senate budget has $60 million for that purpose. There's $59.4 million for Alaska Marine Highway System. That's actually the same amount that was roughly the same amount of the FY22 unrestricted general funds for that, but the governor had eliminated all of that UGF and just utilized federal money instead. There's $27 million for what's called the fuel trigger, which is sending money to state agencies to offset the impact of high oil prices, so it's a sliding scale based on the actual price of oil. There's $16.1 million for the Department of Health to increase personal care attendant wages. And the House had about $8 million for that purpose, but the Senate has a bit broader approach that costs $16 million. There's $14 million of increases for the University of Alaska, $5 million for the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute, $4.3 million for a food bank pilot program, and then a $4.3 million for a 50% increase in the funding to K-12 residential schools, not Mount Edgecombe, but district-operated residential schools.
Is it too late for my amendment to put it in Mount Edgecombe?
Mr. Chairman, I think it's a little late at this point.
Okay. Go ahead.
All right. Slide 11C covers the major increases in the Senate statewide items from the governor's proposal. So the largest, well, not the largest, the first one on the slide is $89.3 million for the PERS-TERS, or sorry, just PERS, not PERS-TERS pension fund. So this is an amount that would have gone to the healthcare side, but the ARM board decided, the Alaska Retirement Management Board decided that because the healthcare side was unfunded, that they would set that rate to zero. The Senate decided instead of just taking that as savings to deposit that savings into the pension fund, which is underfunded. There's $199 million to the permanent fund corpus in FY22. That satisfies an audit finding relating to FY17 and 18 royalties that were not paid in. There's $220.8 million to pay past unfunded school bond debt reimbursement from FY17 through 21. And so that $220 million is compensating for vetoes and other underfunding of that program for the last few years. Municipalities have had to sort of eat that cost and often increase taxes. This would give them back that amount in a lump sum that they could use for any purpose. There's $84 million in FY22 to repay past unfunded REAA deposits in FY17 through 21. Again, those were vetoed and reduced along with the school bond debt reimbursement amounts.
Can you stop for a second?
Sure.
With the noise. We'll have a brief at ease. Just going to let that noise go by. You might want to tell the public what the REAA is.
Yeah, I was about to.
Record. We just paused for a minute because we had some highway traffic out the window. So, Mr. Painter, could you please remind the committee what the REAA stands for?
Mr. Chairman, that stands for the Regional Education Attendance Area Fund. And so those amounts go to pay for construction of rural schools and major maintenance of those schools. Those amounts were reduced along with school debt reimbursement over the past few years. The $84 million of deposits is enough to fund about 2.5 of the schools on the school construction list. Some of that money could also go to some of the major maintenance projects as well.
And just as a reminder to the public, that is tied together with school bond debt reimbursement for the organized boroughs to make it fair across the state for all Alaska's children on funding schools. So they move together in tandem, and that's also what gets involved with a legal settlement also with the Kasaili case. But go ahead and continue.
Mr. Chairman, there's $60 million in this budget to pay oil and gas tax credits at the statutory amount for FY22. Those were unfunded or partially funded due to a failed CBR vote. So there's $349 million for that same purpose in FY23, so combined about $419 million. for that purpose. There's $38.9 million in FY22 to bring the community assistance distributions up to $30 million in each of FY22 and 23. Due to past vetoes, those funds are significantly below the amount. $30 million is the statutory amount for those distributions. Okay, and then one more kind of going back even further in time, September 2021, when we passed House Bill 3001, I believe it was, that funded the last bit of the FY22 budget. So at that point, we were using the spring revenue forecast from 2021. It was significantly lower than even what we had in the fall. So the governor's budget in December already reflected higher oil prices than what we left in the fall. So when we left last fall, we had a $74.2 million post-transfer surplus after we drew from savings. So that was sort of what we had left, and no balance projected to be in the SBR. The revenue forecasts in the spring 2022 compared to spring 2021 increased the amount of revenue we're expecting in FY22 by $2.2 billion and FY23 by about $3.6 billion. So combined, over the 2 years, if you compare to what we were looking at a year ago, we have $5.7 billion of additional revenue available across the two fiscal years. We also have additional ARPA funds, the Coronavirus State and Local Fiscal Relief Fund, or SLRF, that's the 486.6. And then last year we used some one-time savings draws, so if we kind of net those out, we get to basically across FY22 and 23, if we compare to what we were facing last fall, we have $5.7 billion of additional revenue. So a couple of slides ago I said we had about $3.8 billion, but really if we go back even farther, we're significantly better position. A lot of the numbers are the same here, but compared to last year's dividend, the $739 million dividend, the higher PFD plus the energy relief is actually an increase of $2.86 billion over what we had paid last year altogether. So about half of that additional revenue went there. Then the next few numbers are the same as a few slides. So the additional $900 million in the capital budget versus last year's level, $500 million of operating supplementals, which we mostly covered on that last slide, $265 million of higher agency operations than last year, and $349 million of higher statewide items than last year. Altogether, of that $5.7 billion we had available, we spent $4.9 billion of that, leaving that $750 million in savings.
Go ahead and continue.
Okay, so this next few slides, we're getting into projecting the future. So in FY24, after this budget, we have a few scenarios and then some fiscal modeling. So in FY24, the spring revenue forecast calls for $90 oil in FY24. The futures are somewhere around there too. So that's a reduction in the petroleum revenue from last year or from the current year. However, there's an increase in the POMV draw projected from the $3.36 billion to $3.6 billion, so a $240 million increase. So in FY24, based on the spring forecast, revenue would be $600 or $700 million below what we have in FY23. Going down to the budget, the agency operations, we identified $105 million of one-time items in the FY23 budget. The largest of that is the $60 million for K-12. So if we back all of those out, since they're one-time items, and then add 2.25% inflation, we actually end up with a relatively flat budget, a reduction of $13 million or so, just as a starting point. We left in that K-12 disparity test placeholder. It would take a few years to adjust to that if we do fail. In statewide items, there's a reduction. A lot of that is due to the lower oil and gas tax credits, because the $349 million and the $60 million nearly pay those off. There'd be $123 million available or remaining in FY24. So the reduction from that $349 to $123 constitutes the majority of that reduction in statewide items, as we pay off the last of the tax credits. And then for the sake of this, we took out the energy relief. If we added that in, that is basically equivalent to the projected surplus in this scenario. The capital budget, this reflects the amount of general fund match in the current budget. So $152 million of the current capital budget is designated as general fund match. And then we added $100 million as a placeholder for, you know, sort of getting to a normal capital budget. And, you know, in the past, we've used various capital budget placeholders. With the federal infrastructure bill, the amount of match required has increased a little bit. So this $250 million is probably a more reasonable placeholder than I think we've used, you know, $200 million or so in the past. But we have a lot more highway funds and things like that coming forward now than we used to. And then this particular scenario shows a PFD at 50% of the percent of market value draw. So this is what was proposed in the Senate Finance budget. That would leave us with a pre-transfer surplus in FY24 of $842 million, again, roughly the size of that energy relief payment in 23. And at this point, we don't know what the fund transfers would be, so that remains. So just as a starting point in FY24, if we go to the 50-50 dividend, we would have about an $842 million surplus.
I got a couple comments. Senator Bishop has showed up because we got down to looking at this skinny capital budget number. Actually, he was traveling. He showed up, like the record to reflect that. But $252 million looks a little light compared to what's coming. I'd be a little concerned about that. And also, I'd like to just remind the public, we spend a significant amount of time through the budget cycle this year concentrating on improving the liquidity position of the state while producing a reasonable dividend at 50-50, and also helping the communities with their liquidity position, putting the state in a position going forward next year and the year after to start going after some bigger capital projects around, if it's major roads or bridges or railroad extensions, trying to get the railroad to the border of Canada or whatever we're going to do, dealing with our ports. Like to remind the committee of the and the public of some of the previous discussions. If the state isn't in a strong financial position, it's hard for us to go after some of these generational changing capital projects. And we have a question from Senator Wilson and Senator Bishop.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Painter, this is projecting FY24 if the Senate enacted budget is enacted.
Through the chair, yes, that's correct.
So a one-time deficit filling from whatever funds we decide, if that is a deficit, would the following year would end up with a $800 million surplus?
Through the chair, yes. So if this is assuming that in FY23 we have the statutory PFD and the energy relief payment, and then in FY24 go to just the 50-50. So that's where the surplus comes from. If you did the statutory PFD in FY24, it'd look significantly different.
Right. So just one more. So this could work.
Pardon me, I couldn't hear you.
This could work. If I'm just saying that you would have a surplus the following year if the budget was just a one-time budget, looking forward to the next following year, you would have a $842 million surplus. And looking at the other accounts at the year end of the year, balances seem to be in a better position as well.
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, I mean, yes, if we hit the forecast in both years, then I think we would have remaining balances in the SBR and then facing a potential surplus in FY24 if then we switch to the 50-50 dividend formula. If we remained at the statutory dividend formula, you know, which I think is about $2.8 billion projected in FY24, you know, that would put us back in a deficit in FY24. So that's a pretty big assumption that the energy relief and statutory dividend are a one-time item. But if they are, then and oil hits the forecast, then yes, FY24 would look fairly positive.
On that point, Mr.
Okay, on that point, then we'll go to Senator.
On that point, it could work, but there's a little pesky thing called the Constitution that requires us to balance the budget for FY23. And I, for one, will not violate that constitution by spending, overspending, and having a $1.2 billion deficit. That's just my personal opinion. You know, it's just a pesky little thing called the Constitution. Thank you, Mr. President.
We also have to recognize oil prices are extremely hard to predict and very volatile. Anybody that could show otherwise, I'd like to have them come to the committee to make our life easier. Senator Bishop.
Thank you. I just want to go back to the capital budget and dovetail on a couple of things. We don't know what we don't know, and there's over hundreds of billions of dollars in IIJA grant funding, competitive grants out there that are going to be open for all comers to apply for. We don't know what those match requirements will be if we're successful in Alaska to get some of those to for matching those grants, or if we are successful. So that's good. You said this was just a placeholder, base 252. And one other thing is, you know, and I'm on my soapbox. You want to move Alaska forward? There's two things that'll do it: lower the corporate income tax rate for businesses to come in here, and cheap energy, not affordable energy, cheap energy. And you put $1 billion in the intertie, and raising the dam height and bring more water into Bradley Lake and look at other cheap energy projects. That's where we should be concentrating our capital budget on those big legacy projects. The last thing I'll say is on assumptions, they're just that.
Okay, go on to slide 14.
Mr. Chairman, so slide 14 is a fiscal model carrying basically that slide out through FY31. And so you can see that surplus in FY24, the revenue forecast calls for kind of continuing oil price declines for the next few years, so that surplus shrinks over the next few years to about half the size in FY25 and then roughly balanced budget in 26, and then dipping into deficits from FY27 through 30. Again, this is using that 50% of PMV going to the permanent fund dividend. So, you know, that based on just the expectation that oil is going to end up back in the $70 to $80 per barrel range that the spring forecast has, those surpluses would only last a few years and then go into deficits. Next slide, slide 15, is a probabilistic stress test. And so in FY, I guess I'll orient the members of the slide. The committee has seen these a few times, but for members of the public, on the left we have the surplus or deficit by fiscal year. The blue bars show the median value. The green bars are the 25th and 75th percentile values, meaning that 75% of the time the revenue will be higher than that lower one, and 25% of the time it will be higher than that higher one. And then the black bars represent the 10th through 90th percentile. So the vast majority of the time you'll be somewhere on that black bar. That red line there is the budget balancing price. And so you can see the medians look fairly similar to the last one. You can see the range of outcomes where, you know, just looking at the 25th and 75th percentile, we could be looking at anywhere from $1 billion deficits to $1 billion surpluses throughout this period. And, you know, looking at the larger bars, you know, we could be looking at deficits ranging from $2 billion to a surplus of, you know, $2 to $3 billion. Over on the right, we have the range of potential ERA balances in the permanent fund. And so in the median, there's a bit of a decline over time. A lot of that's due to the expectation that the fund will grow more slowly than inflation. Just even without any overdraws, there's also some scenarios in which overdrawing the permanent fund is necessary, and that drags that down a little bit. But the range of that of the values are pretty wide. By FY31, in 25% of the scenarios, there's $0 in the earnings reserve account. In 25% of the scenarios, there's at least $30 billion in the account. So there's a very high range of values for the earnings reserve. On the bottom, we have the probabilities of various CBR or SBR and SBR combined balances. So in FY23, there's 100% probability that the CBR and SBR will be below $2.5 billion, and the reason is because of that revenue cap, that $100 a barrel. There's no scenario in which those funds exceed $2.5 billion. And then in the subsequent years, because of that projection of the surplus in FY24, in a lot of scenarios, there are more reserves going forward. Overall, there's about a 40% chance of having less than $2.5 billion in savings, 60% chance of having more than that. And then this next one is the probability that the CBR and SBR are below $500 million. $500 million is kind of what we need for cash flow. So we have that as when we would trigger an ERA draw to fill the deficit. In FY23, that happens 30% of the time. Going forward, that's a in the high teens to low 20s percent of the time that we would need an ERA overdraw to balance the budget.
A couple things. What's the rate of inflation you're using, and what's the inflation trends that are out in the press and the signaling from the Federal Reserve Board?
Chairman, so this uses 2.25% inflation, which is Callan's official number. Obviously, in the short term, that looks very low. In the longer term, that I think they're assuming that the Federal Reserve is going to eventually bring that down. But certainly right now we're facing significantly higher inflation than the, I think we had 4.5% or 4.7%, something like that last year.
And then to the earlier comment about how well this would work at the table, and listening to a couple of the members and then the other member concerned about the Constitution requirements, I think we have a requirement to pay back the CBR. So is these budget proposals going to help us get that accomplished, or do we just ignore that?
Mr. Chairman, so the repayment mechanism is sort of the sweep of the surplus at the end of the year. So these scenarios in which we have a significant surplus, if we just allow that to sweep instead of, as we do in FY22, we place that surplus in the statutory budget reserve instead of repaying the CBR. We could pay back the CBR in these surplus scenarios, or the legislature could choose to divert it as they did this year, where we did not repay the CBR with that surplus. So there is a constitutional requirement, but the mechanism is, can be kind of stepped around by depositing it elsewhere.
So we have a requirement, constitutional requirement to have a balanced budget. We've got a constitutional requirement to pay back the CBR. And I think, just as a reminder, CBR has no interest rate and no time frame on it, but it's still there. It needs to be recognized as a liability. Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you just remind me where in the Constitution that requirement is to balance the budget?
Through the Chair, Senator Wilikowski, I don't have a Constitution in front of me, but there's no requirement that each year's budget is necessarily balanced. It's that there always has to be revenue to pay our expenditures, and so that includes savings balances. So we ran deficits from FY13 through FY21, but we utilized reserve balances to do that. So it kind of gets into, when do we call something a deficit? We call it a deficit when our ongoing revenue is less than our ongoing expenditures. But as long as we have a source to fill that, which in this, the Senate budget, through $93 a barrel is the statutory budget reserve, that is technically a balanced budget. There is a source to balance the budget. I think if the Senate passed a budget that balanced an amount greater than the spring forecast, we would have an unbalanced budget. Or if the Senate had not adopted that amendment to fill the deficit out of the SBR, that would have been an unbalanced budget. As it is, based on the spring forecast, that is a balanced budget utilizing reserve balances. So, in conversations with legislative legal, I don't think we have any concerns that it's not a constitutional budget. However, if you had revenue declining, we would then have a shortfall that would have to be filled out of somewhere that this bill does not fill below $93 a barrel.
So when the bill left the committee, we did not have backfill language in it because it wasn't needed. And a lot of members felt it would just encourage overspending, looking at the high price of oil. So that backfill language was added on the floor of the Senate to allow pork barrel spending and to technically then have a balanced budget that would not be rejected by a governor because it was in deficit. So we're relying on the savings. But just as a reminder, we did not have that at the committee when that bill left for that very purpose. So this would not happen. Anyway, next page, please.
All right, so the next slide shows a fiscal summary that is identical to the last one, except that this is with a 75-25 PFD, as requested by the committee. So this shows with 25% of the percent of market value draw, or just almost exactly $900 million going to the permanent fund dividend. And that would have a surplus of $1.7 billion in FY24 versus the $800 million in the previous slide.
Is there a typo in the lower left-hand, right-hand box as far as should it be 23 and 24 and the titles there?
Mr. Chairman, yes, that should be FY23 and 24.
Okay, and then on that, I see in 24, which we haven't done yet, I see the surplus going into the SBR, but we haven't structured that yet, and the CBR is the normal default savings account unless we decide, and those watching at home, the CBR again takes three-quarter vote. The SBR, the statutory budget reserve, simple majority, we make a informed decision or policy call when we direct the money into the SBR. If we don't do that, it automatically defaults to the CBR. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. And probably this slide should show that going into the CBR as the default, and then the legislature could choose to do otherwise.
Okay. Just for those watching at home, there's a lot of complexities in these budgets. So, okay, we want to go on to the next page.
Sure. So the next slide, again, is a fiscal model with that 75-25%. So you see in FY24 a surplus of $1.7-1.8 billion, and those surpluses persist over the entire modeling period. So they do drop a little bit, but are at least $780 million throughout the period here, which would, in this scenario anyway, just go into savings rather than be spent, and would result in a CBR balance of about $11 billion by FY31. And this next slide stress tests that. So it shows that, you know, the medians, there's surpluses every year, those blue bars. At the 25th percentile, that's roughly a balanced budget. So, you know, that kind of shows the range that at the 75th percentile, we're looking at $2 billion surpluses. At the 25th, we're looking at balanced budgets. And then in the 10th and 90th percentiles, we could go anywhere from a deficit of $1 billion to a surplus of $4 billion in FY31. So there's a very wide range of outcomes in this scenario. And I'd note that here on the right, there's still a 25% chance that the ERA will go to zero, even with this more positive scenario and very low percentages of overdraws. That's because with the volatility of the stock market, there's a chance that the ERA will go to zero even without any overdraws. So that probability is reflected here on the right.
That's your final slide?
Mr. Chairman, yes, I believe it is.
We have questions. Thank you, more questions, Senator. Any other questions? Thank you for your presentation. I see our handouts by the door disappear, and that's what they're for. Hopefully they're not going in the trash. People are actually taking a look at them. We'll print some more. We have some handouts. We've got some handouts that we'll get the handouts reprinted, so we have some more of them. We have one that goes from FY16 through the current budget, FY23, dealing with the agencies and statewide operations and the dividend and the capital budget to show the expenditures year by year. My office does have one that's inflation adjusted, and Ledge Finance does also, same sheet, I think. If you're interested in the inflation adjusted one, let us know. We'll get that to you, but we'll make sure that there's some of these are printed out, and we'll probably have some other of these fiscal handouts on the table there if anybody in the building wants to come up or get them online. They are available or press. With that, I'd like to, you have any final comments?
Mr. Chairman, I was reminded that we skipped over slide 6 to go back to it because we're out of order here. So one final slide. I apologize to Senator Wilikowski, but this perhaps ties in there's a slide on new revenues. So in some of these scenarios, we saw deficits in the later years. This is kind of a update on what new revenues could potentially fill those deficits. These numbers primarily come from the Department of Revenue. They have a fiscal model tool on their website that has some of these new revenue options. So the sales tax options are two different sales tax proposals. One, the first one raises $175 million per percent, is exempts things like groceries and fuel and utilities. So it's a bit of a narrower base, but perhaps would impact people in certain parts of the state, certain income brackets a little less. So that would be $175 million per 1% of that sales tax. If you have minimal exemptions, that would raise $275 million per percent. And then these income tax numbers, the Department of Revenue did not provide these. These are legislative finance numbers. Per 1% of adjusted gross income, which is the federal number on your tax return, we'd get about $300 million. Another way to structure an income tax, the way Alaska's was in the 70s and before, would be a percentage of federal tax liability. You get about 1% per, $40 million per percent of federal tax liability. So that's another way to structure it. That's, you just take that number on your federal taxes, but it does mean that we would be a little exposed to changes in federal tax codes. Then we have a couple of one oil production tax option that the Department of Revenue modeled on their page, which is to reduce the per barrel tax credit, which is currently $8, by $3, so down to $5. That has no impact at $40 oil or below. At $60 oil, that change would increase revenues by $293 million. Anything above $70 oil, the difference would be $435 million. And so that's kind of a simple change to the tax system that DOR has modeled, but obviously there's many other options on that particular thing. In terms of implementation timelines, an income and sales tax would take at least a year to implement. So a lot of times we've looked at, if we passed it during a session, the following fiscal year we may get half a year's revenue. So the optimistic, the rush timeline would be if we passed one this year, by January of next year we could start, have a tax in place. The Department of Revenue said they would like longer if we could give them longer, but that's sort of the fastest version. Oil production tax changes can be implemented more quickly, so instead of, you know, getting a half year's revenue, they can usually have those sometimes even retroactive. So it's a little easier because they don't have to set up a new program to do that.
You said retroactive, not the chairman, by the way. Any questions on this slide? Go ahead, Senator Bishop.
Thank you. Mr. Painter, did on these sales tax, income tax, did they post any fiscal notes on their website of how many more new employees we'd need to have to stand these divisions up and what that would cost?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, I think when they presented to the fiscal plan working group last year, they showed some of those numbers net of the cost of implementation. I'm not sure if that's how their fiscal model is structured. I'm not sure if Mr. Bell behind me is nodding a yes or no. He may be able to confirm that. But in the past, they've tried to present those net of the cost of implementation in response to similar questions, but I'm not sure if they are right now.
Thank you.
Do we have any other questions for Mr. Painter of Ledge Finance before we take a brief at ease? Okay, seeing none, thank you for coming forward. Hopefully you'll be available for questions of other legislative members and staff in the building the next couple of days on this subject, because there is some confusion and a lot of moving parts. Okay, we're at ease.
Okay, we'll come back on the record. Apologize for the interruption, but it's the end of the session and we're juggling many balls in the air. We have about 25 minutes left in the time allotment for this morning's meeting, and I think the next subject matter, Senate Bill 107, Oil and Gas Production Tax and Credits. It would be better if Senator Wilikowski didn't have to do half his presentation and then have a 2-3 hour break and come back for the other half. It would be preferred that we slide Senator Wilikowski to the 1 o'clock slot so he has ample time to lay out his proposed bill and his arguments. So we will do that. I've talked to him and he's fine with that. So we're going to adjourn this morning's meeting. We'll reconvene at 1 o'clock and we'll have a presentation by Senator Wilikowski on SB 107. And then I'll, in the meantime, Senator Bishop has returned to the committee. He'll be reviewing bills and he may have a couple of bills for action and he may not, depending on when he sits down and takes a look at the position of the bills and what's going on in the building. So we thank everybody for tuning in this morning. We are adjourned at 11 or 10, 35.